Welcome to the Wedlake Bell Legal Podcast, covering a range of legal topics, including updates from our four practice groups: private client, real estate, business services, and dispute resolution.
Hello, my name's Suzanne Gill, and welcome to this issue of the Wedlake Bell Legal Podcast. I'm joined today by my partner and co-founder of the Tomorrow's Cities Today's Challenge campaign, Helen Garthwaite.
It's great to join you, Suzanne. Our Tomorrow's City Today's Challenge initiative started from the World Health Organization prediction that by 2030, over 60% of the world's population will live in cities. It asked what this will mean for the built environment and those who work in it. And what should we, clients, consultants, lawyers, be doing now to get ready for increased urbanisation and the changes to the way we all live, work and interact with our surroundings? Wedlake Bell regularly holds debates with thought leaders from industry and academia to consider the issues and challenges and develop solutions. Our thinking is frequently picked up in the press. We hosted a great debate at our offices recently on the theme of retail therapy, the future of retail and particularly wellness in tomorrow's city. We were lucky enough to be joined by a superb range of panellists.
Yes, these were Zana Busby of Retail Reflections, who's a business psychologist, Dan Johnson, the director of placemaking at the New West End Company, Paul O'Grady, who runs the South Belgrave portfolio for the Grosvenor Estate in London, and Faye Wilson, who leads the Change Lab innovation programme across the John Lewis Partnership. Now, the first issue the panel considered was the polarisation of retail into convenience, for which we're cheaper, and experiential retail. Today's buzz in retail is omnichannel retailing. This reflects that the consumer can buy products in store, online, subscription, mail order, click and collect, by phone, tablet or computer. The panel were looking at the future impact of experiential retailing.
Before we get into that, perhaps we should briefly touch on the experience economy. If you buy a book, you are contributing to the traditional economy, and the output is the physical book itself. However, if you pay to hear an author at a book fair, this is part of the experience economy. The only output of the event of the book fair is your memory of it. Now, the experience economy is nothing new and was identified by the Harvard Business Review as long as 20 years ago. However, what is new is the trend for wellness and lifestyle issues, which will play a much greater part in it. For example, the sports retailer Lululemon runs yoga classes at many of its stores. Their customers can experience the yoga class and may or may not buy sportswear afterwards. So, when retailers are building brand loyalty and driving sales in this way, are there legal issues to be aware of?
Well, there are, Helen, and I'm very glad you asked that. One legal issue which comes straight to the forefront, to my mind anyway, is that of turnover rent leases. So, turnover rent leases have been used a lot by landlords of shopping centres. The retailer pays a proportion of a standard market rent, normally about 80%. The retailer also pays a rent based on its turnover at that particular year and store and shares sales and other data with the landlord. The percentage of turnover will be carefully judged by the shopping centre owner to mean that the base rent plus the turnover rent should equal the full open market rent if the retailer is doing reasonably well. And for a clothing retailer, the turnover percentage might be about 8 or 9%. Now, if sales fall, perhaps because the shopping centre itself is not doing well, the retailer is protected because the rent for its unit also falls. By contrast, if the shopping centre runs a series of very successful events and promotions, the turnover rises and both retailer and shopping centre owner share in the benefit of the increased turnover. As a kind of geeky legal aside, I would note that alienation provisions in the lease probably have more control and perhaps an offer back clause in a shopping centre of that nature. Now, online sales have been and will continue to be an issue for the calculation of turnover rents. However, when events such as the yoga class or the book fair are free or subsidised, and as consumers make their purchases either in store or perhaps once they've got home, the relevance of turnover in any given stores to the profitability of the store's occupier becomes less and less important. retail values are under considerable pressure at the moment, and to my mind, the growth of experiential retailing might properly be considered as a form of leisure, and turnover rents become much less relevant and possibly less desirable.
Suzanne, you mentioned online sales impacting on the high street. You will recall that in an earlier debate, our Tomorrow's City, Today's Challenge initiative looked at ageing in Urbis, growing old in Tomorrow's City, picking up on the ageing demographic trend of the population. I was interested to hear our panellists also touch on this consumer sector in the retail space. Will they use the future high street or rely on online purchasing?
Yes, when we asked the panel about the grey pound, as it's called, I was particularly interested to hear from Dan Johnson of the New West End Company. Now, the New West End Company deals with a high street in a very fragmented legal ownership, although that high street has been around since Roman times and is more commonly known as Oxford Street. Both the New West End Company and the Grosvenor Estate have large land holdings in a relatively compact area, so it's clearly in their interest to spend money making the environment outside the stores welcoming for shoppers of all sorts so that they come, stay for a long time when they do come, and come back more and more often.
That's very interesting. I recall there was talk of making the high street more accessible for the elderly, including rethinking streetscape with changed infrastructure and fit out of retail space designed for this group who have significant spending power and loyalty.
Yes, Dan raised a similar point about the purple pound dealing with disabled shoppers. For a start, when they go to a store, they tend to bring at least one family member. Secondly, once they know the store is accessible and meets their needs, they tend to come back again and again. Disabled customers would much rather have the certainty of somewhere that they know is accessible than risk going to a new destination. And retailers are responding to all sorts of needs with set no music hours or the non-use of flashing light displays. This really shows the role of Disability Discrimination Act compliance and building regulations. If a store's wheelchair accessible, it's also accessible for pushchairs and for those who simply struggle with stairs.
And remember, that can be somebody who's just had a skiing accident, is it not, on crutches. So opportunities can be seen which future retail design could address. And most of our current cities, though, Suzanne, aren't in a single ownership along the high street, though. There's no shopping centre owner or landlord owning the whole road. So who'll see the benefit of investing in the area outside the buildings? What can be done about them?
Well, the legal solution is business improvement districts, or BIDs as they're commonly called. In practice, an energetic and determined team of local businesses can band together to create a BID. This allows them to levy a small charge on business rates, which can then be spent to raise the standard of the entire community environment. They also come with some business rates advantages. On a local level, this is well worth looking at.
Is there anything else?
Well, the other legal change which might develop as shops become more like showrooms than sale points could be the demise of the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954. That act allows tenants security of tenure, a right to a new lease when the current one ends, unless their landlords can meet one of seven statutory reasons to refuse the lease renewal. When your biggest sale point is the World Wide Web, maybe being in this particular spot on this particular high street will be less of an issue.
Yes, you say that, but I think the panel was pretty clear that people need to be positively attracted to a physical location and tempted to stay and explore there. If the environmental features such as pleasant parks, wide pavements, clean air can be guaranteed, retailers will want to be in that place to get the footfall. I don't think we can write off the 1954 Act quite just yet.
Okay. Now, one of the themes we often touch on in Tomorrow's City's Today's Challenge debates is technological disruption. More consumer data than ever before is being created, including in relation to people's health and vital statistics. Paul O'Grady from the Grosvenor Estate was able to talk about some of the data sets used by the estates, both at the Liverpool One shopping centre and in central London. I was interested to hear that in London they're measuring air quality as one of the factors which is likely to encourage people to come and stay in the West End. Walkability is becoming more widely recognised as a key factor in the attractiveness of an area, so anyone involved in placemaking should really consider this and make sure the planning obligations permit, or indeed require, the balance between cars, pedestrians and bicycles that they think are appropriate.
We can certainly see this on the horizon in London. Pedestrian zones create challenges for retail deliveries, though. Also, construction works to retail space become a challenge, on which more shortly. That reminds me also of a Tomorrow's City debate we ran a few years ago about the role of women in Tomorrow's City. Vienna in Austria looked at gender differences in transport habits some while ago now, and there were some quite interesting outcomes from that study. Typically, men make one long journey from home to work at the start of the day, and the same journey back at the end of the day. Women, however, tend to make a number of smaller fragmented journeys, dropping children at childcare on the way to school, popping into a shop on the way to work, perhaps going past a family member on the way home. Their journeys were much more fragmented.
So if you look at the data around gender split of journeys, that's got real implications for retail habits and for opportunities.
Transport hubs are used much more by women than men, which is a point that can be missed if the planners don't reflect the population they serve. Vienna's building and transport policies were redesigned to reflect this. These gender differences are particularly important to anyone considering the grey pound and its increasing importance as the population ages, because many women tend to live longer than men. So what could this mean for developing the mix of retail at hubs, and what could this mean for landlords and tenants of these areas?
Well, for landlords, the tenant mix policies for hubs will start to become more and more important. There's already a body of established case law about a tenant mix policy in shopping centres, and the key advice is that the tenant mix policy must be written down and very clear and public. If, as a landlord, you want to refuse consent for a lease to be assigned to an incoming retailer, you've got to be able to document why you're focusing your retailers of that sort in one place and what can and can't be permitted.
Another thread on the technology front coming out of the panel discussion was that experiential retail will continue to evolve with new technology. There have been reports of some shopping centres using facial recognition technology. Suzanne, will this throw up legal challenges?
Yes, as well as issues around public acceptance of this, there are legal constraints around especially sensitive data and the care which people must take with that, and those are contained in the Data Protection Act and, of course, the GDPR.
Yes, certainly this has prompted a proliferation of emails for consent to use retail data by retailers. I know that just from the number hitting my screen.
So facial recognition technology is a bit more big brother than most UK consumers are prepared to accept at the moment. But that may change as people get used to it. The other trend we've seen in relation to big set data and retailing is concern that algorithms are set up to adopt predatory pricing practices. For example, deliberately allocating families separate seats on aeroplanes so they feel obliged to pay extra to be seated together. As a matter of health and safety and aviation law, very young children cannot be anywhere other than next to their parents on a plane, so the plane can be evacuated safely and quickly in the event of an emergency. Now, the Unfair Contract Terms Act might also be relevant to predatory pricing, as long as it's enforced, of course.
Certainly, if we were to make a prediction, I think there's a role for case law to evolve the legislation here.
Another way that building owners keep their stores attractive to customers and keep them coming back is to constantly refresh what's on offer there. We've seen that pop-ups are becoming more and more popular, and many retailers are starting to blend the way that properties are used.
Yes, retail market stall outlets, ice rinks, catwalks and in-store demonstration and lifestyle space illustrate this rather well, with the increasing demand for flexibility to permit customisation, both within retail buildings themselves and their environs. This presents some changing construction and FM challenges. Fit-out documentation will now need to respond to new health and safety requirements, insurance risks, use of wider materials in non-permanent structures, prefabrication, perhaps off-site. Quite commonly, modern methods of construction and assembly are likely to be seen here first. Property documentation and local authorities will need to facilitate these new uses and temporary retail. Will areas designated for this in the public realm start to be seen?
Well, as free time is such a precious commodity for so many people, shopping might properly be considered as leisure rather than activity. This was one of Zana's points, but it's got really interesting implications for planning law, believe it or not. At the moment, certain standard activities are allocated what's called a use class. Some movement between use classes is permitted without planning permission. Anything particularly unusual has a so-called sui generis use, a Latin name which essentially means the uses don't fall into the four main categories. The mainly relevant use classes for today's debate is that retailing uses are A, so shops are A1, cafes and restaurants are A3, drinking establishments such as wine bars are A4, and hot food restaurants are A5. Businesses have B use classes, residential have C uses, and leisure use is D2. Yet at Wedlake Bell, we've spoken to clients considering a blend of food and wellness who are neither food nor leisure, so need to get a new sui generis planning permission every single time for a new unit. Getting a planning permission can be slow and cumbersome, and so perhaps it's time to look again at the use classes order and the ease of moving between them.
Surely lease terms come back into play here too, don't they?
Yes, the use permitted by many leases is linked to the planning use class, because the landlord doesn't want you to break the law by using an illegal planning use. So often landlord consent is needed before the retailer applies for a new planning permission. Traditionally, the planning permission does have an impact on the value of the property, so it's understandable. But it also means that legal terms of agreements might be operating as a fetter on growth and on change.
Stores themselves are constantly refreshing their own brand to maintain a conversation with their customers. Any brand which is important in terms of value needs to be properly protected using intellectual property and copyright provisions. While that's established law, how will brands protect the financial value of what marketing consultants might call the character or personality of the brand? It will be interesting to see how intellectual property law develops around this.
The other implications of pop-ups and a more experiential retail approach is that both the design and delivery of stores might be different in future.
For example, do they all need to be the same size? In a shopping centre, even the shopfront is standard in design. Will the specification be to the bare shell and core? Or will landlords be expected to provide a basic specification so that someone can literally move in and set up their unit?
And of course, this means the duration of the lease and the break rights also need to be reviewed. Now, many landlords are prepared to contemplate this, but then discover they're constrained by the terms of their lender's requirements if they have a mortgage.
I agree. Current approaches to valuation and financing retail space are likely to need modification going forward.
Right, we've covered a lot of ground today, Helen, so to close, here's a quick summary.
Suzanne's prediction is for the end of turnover rent leases. For retailers in future, the brand will start to need more protection than the physical store.
Planning use classes, established in the aftermath of World War II and the Blitz, could do with quite a serious refresh.
A variety and curated mix of property and experience is likely to come to the fore, impacting on value as well as property construction and finance documentation.
Finally, data protection laws are especially relevant to wellness issues because the protection and the penalties for personal data is much, much stronger. That's all we've got time for today. Thanks for listening.
You just listened to the Wedlake Bell Legal Podcast. If you liked our episode and want to know more, then check out our website, www.wedlakebell.com. Wedlake Bell. Building relationships is at the heart of everything we do.